Chapter 3. They're All You've Got. If it is easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism, it is still perhaps easier to imagine the end of capitalism than the end of the family. Sophie Lewis. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you. And though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. Khalil Gibran. Brittany knows that her daddy loves her. Vivian L. Thorine, the lawyer for Spears' father, told the US publication People in March 2021, months prior to his suspension from her conservatorship. Brittany, meanwhile, says that her family has lived off her exploitation, leaving her traumatized, that her father loved the control to hurt his own daughter, that he is obsessed with her. "You're allowing my dad to ruin my life," she pleaded with the judge. "I have to get rid of my dad." In November 2021, a judge ended a conservatorship that had limited her freedom for almost 14 years. During those 14 years, Spears released 3 albums, appeared on television, and had a residency in Las Vegas. Yet, since a mental health crisis in 2008, when she was detained in psychiatric hospitals twice, she was deemed unfit for autonomy. Under the legal guardianship, her father, Jamie Spears, and others had strict control over intimate aspects of her life, including decisions about her finances, career, medication, relationships, and seeing her children. Court records show the conservatorship dictated everything from the color of her kitchen cabinets to who she could see to her use of the contraceptive coil. According to the documentary Controlling Britney Spears, her father, who has been accused of physical and verbal abuse, also placed her under 24-hour surveillance, bugging her home and her phone. Now that Britney is free, thanks in part to the hashtag Free Britney campaign that had been, like Spears herself, dismissed as crazy, it is widely known that she was exploited by her father. The profits of her labour as a pop star were tightly controlled by him, and over the years of her conservatorship, she was forced to pay him nearly $20,000 per month, as well as cover legal fees and the cost of psychiatric intervention she did not consent to. Like babies born into capitalism everywhere, to her family, Spears was a sort of property. She was, as Sophie Lewis puts it, a product of the tendency among nuclear families to make babies in the shape of personal mascots, psychic crutches, heirs, scapegoats and fetishes, not forgetting avatars of binary sex. Now she has been released from her father's authority. Spears herself wants the real deal, telling the court she wants to get married and have a baby. Why would someone so harmed by the institution of the family want to make one herself? Why does anyone? Because of an inevitable biological drive? Because it's where love lives? Or something else? Family and how it fucks us up. The nuclear family, a monogamous couple and their offspring, who reside in a private household, has a short history, with its roots in white supremacist, heteropatriarchal capitalism. This way of organizing society into small, atomized units was designed in the service of capital, and yet it has been naturalized, ahistoricized, and generally accepted as a politically neutral, universal moral good. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights itself states that the family is the natural and fundamental group unit of society and is entitled to protection by society and the state. In the Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels wrote, "The bourgeoisie has torn away from the family its sentimental veil and has reduced the family relation to a mere money relation. With the growth of industrial capitalism, the dominant kinship structure in the West came to be the nuclear family, a heterosexual marriage with a male breadwinner and children raised in a private household. This form replaced earlier, more diverse household arrangements, including more collective forms of living with extended families or non-biological kin. As a social unit, the nuclear family imposed sexual monogamy on women because of anxieties about keeping inheritance within the patriarchal bloodline. Marriage did not come with the expectation of sexual exclusivity for men until much more recently. Besides hoarding property and wealth, the family serves other functions for capital. Rather than placing demands on the state or communal support networks, the family privatizes care. In the unpaid drudgery of women, Domestic labour is social reproduction, cooking, cleaning, and other life-sustaining support that keeps workers alive enough to work, and babies alive enough to grow up to be workers themselves. The family, too, functions as, to quote the psychoanalyst David Cooper, an ideological conditioning device. The family trains people to perform roles, wife, husband, son, daughter, as befits capitalism, and teaches them the ideologies, including of race, gender, and sexuality, upon which the system depends. The benefits of citizenship, in many cases, are tied to one's membership of a nuclear family. Whilst the nuclear family was once the reserve of the bourgeoisie, the rise of the workers' movement by the end of the 19th century saw it become a symbol of respectability, as M.E. O'Brien explains. The characteristic family ideal of the workers' movement was the single male wage earner, supporting an unwaged housewife, their children enrolled in school, their home a respectable centre of moral and sexual conformity. This family form was a tremendous victory in improving the standard of living and survival of millions of working-class people, and creating a basis for stable neighbourhood organisation, sustained socialist struggle, and major political victories. It was also the means by which the workers' movement would distinguish itself from the lumpen proletariat, black workers, and queers. This family form would provide a sexual and gender basis for white American identity and middle-class property ownership. O'Brien argues that the nuclear family form became a manner by which white people, apart from the poorest and most marginalised, like sex workers and queers, set themselves apart from and cast themselves as superior to colonised subjects. When Western nations invaded countries in the global south, enforcing imperialist rule, the institution of marriage and the nuclear family were forced upon colonised people, often replacing more expansive, communal, and less patriarchal forms of kinship. Indigenous people, explains Kim Toolbear, have endured colonial violence against our kin systems, including the kidnapping of children of previous generations from Indigenous families who were impoverished by colonialism and deemed unfit for not attaining the middle-class nuclear family structures of white colonialists. The troubling history of the nuclear family form, of course, does not change the fact that most of us are born into something like it today. Indeed, whilst we may understand its origins in domination and violence, the fact is that many of us depend upon a version of the family as we know it for our survival, and possibly aspire to have one of our own someday, even, or perhaps especially, if our original own was traumatizing. Whilst, systematically speaking, it has nefarious aims, family, as a personal life experience, promises to, and sometimes actually does, albeit possibly due to a lack of other options, meet a lot of our needs as humans. Not only is our family supposed to feed us and provide shelter, it is also supposed to nurture our souls as the foundation of our security, comfort, and belonging in the world. For better or worse, the family might be our primary source of care, the place where we get our first lessons in love. And for some, a family might provide refuge from the oppressions of society at large, from the racist state and racism on the streets, from exploitative bosses and heartless work. Playing happy families. An idealised vision of the family is drilled into us from childhood. At school, from a young age, the family, almost always via heteronormative rhetoric and imagery, is construed as the inevitable, happy and moral culmination of human endeavour. Even if we go home to miserable, disturbing or violent families, at school we draw happy families under bright suns and rehearse their lives at break time. Television, films, and advertisements tell us what families should be, ideally blissful, and if not, at least loyal. Children, if silently, might be savvy to the dishonesty of this fable. This perhaps explains why children's authors who explore the messy realities of families are so popular. When I was a child, lots of us enjoyed reading Jacqueline Wilson, who was Children's Laureate from 2005 to 2007. Her books depict families struggling with poverty, abuse, homelessness, divorce, and unwanted pregnancies. Having grown up in a working-class family, with parents in a rocky relationship, Wilson says that as a child, she was troubled by 1950s and 60s books and television, which portrayed a soft, pastel world without any serious quarrels or money worries. She knew there was a darker world around. More recently, now in her 70s, and having ended her 4-decades-long marriage to a man and partnered with a woman, she has published a queer love story for teens. Family doesn't keep its promises. Whilst purporting to be a bastion of safety and care, the family as we know it is society's primary breeding ground for the oppression of women and children, gendered violence, queerphobia, and transphobia. Government statistics show that of all the women murdered in the year ending March 2020, almost half were killed in their own homes, most likely by a current or former partner or another male family member. This compares to 7% of men killed at home and 2% by a current or former partner. Referencing the murderousness of the nuclear family for women is but one extreme measure of its frequent failure to live up to its soft pastel ideal. The nuclear family is also where many children are emotionally, physically, and sexually abused. It is the social unit in which queer and trans children face their first invalidations, bullying, denials of healthcare, and often total rejection. It is where many disabled people have their first experiences of isolation, dearth of care, and ableist abuse. Reproduction in the nuclear family equates to, as the revolutionary feminist writer Shulamith Firestone puts it, a baby all your own to fuck up as you please. Not only does the nuclear family usually fail to meet its own apparent purpose as a safe and loving haven, it is often the antithesis, the source of our deepest suffering, and concurrently a site of suppression where trauma is silenced, papered over, or denied. Many radical psychoanalysts in the 1960s and 70s, including R.D. Lang, identified the family as having manufactured psychosis in their patients. By inflicting rigid social categories and dynamics, they contended, family structures create untenable internal conflicts that cause what is then understood as mental illness. The experience of the family as an unsafe arrangement is common, yet scarcely given voice to. Since privacy is a fundamental building block of the nuclear unit, abuses within it are usually configured as private matters, which enables their perpetuation. Just before he was elected as Prime Minister, Boris Johnson's neighbours called the police on him, having heard his partner, Carrie Simmons, screaming and shouting, "Get off me!" When asked about the incident, Johnson said, "I do not talk about stuff involving my family." The state of the family, the state, and the family. The modern family looks different to how it did even 50 years ago. Some people claim it is now broken or under threat. Certainly, rising divorce rates, blended families, single-parent households, gay marriage, and more women, not only the very richest, outsourcing their domestic labour to poorer women, have changed the shape of the nuclear family. But these factors have not, as some on the right claim, entirely destroyed it as an institution. Among those on the left, anxiety around the apparent demise of the family is more often articulated in assertions that the instability of neoliberal life, with declining wages, precarious work, and poor public services, is making family life impossible. They claim that the government is not doing enough to ensure people have sufficient money and resources to start a family, or is not looking after families in their policies. But it is not only families the state is neglecting. The state is neglecting people. It is not doing enough to ensure that people, whatever configuration with others or not they are living in or want to live in, survive, let alone live fulfilling lives. It is true that more families today look different from the traditional nuclear form, and it is true that people, including families, are left to languish by the state. But the family as an institution and the ideologies that underpin it remains powerful. In 2016, Mark Fisher explained to his students that even though the nuclear family is historically very new, it has assumed this quasi-transcendental normativity. He asked them if anyone had lived in a commune, to no response, and lamented that as little as 20 years ago, there probably would have been some people in the room who had. As he saw it, young people were increasingly resigned to the nuclear family form, compared, say, to when he was at school in the 1980s, when there were fairly serious debates about alternatives. This fact was a tragedy, he felt, especially because the idealization of family doesn't reflect most people's experience of it at all. Family today, he said, might be empirically weak, but it's transcendentally strong. In many respects, the neoconservatism that arose in the 1960s, to push back against the liberation movements and their challenge to the dominance of the nuclear family, is burgeoning today. Threats to rights related to gender and sexuality are gaining force. The family values agenda, which advocates for the preservation and propagation of the institution of the traditional nuclear family as a matter of morality, is gaining strength. This agenda has its modern origins in far-right evangelism in the United States, where conservative Christian groups campaign against abortion, divorce, queer relationships, and sex outside of marriage. And they are influential. In 2022, abortion bans swept the US. These groups actively seek to further their cause in Europe. The US-based International Organization for the Family, a network of pro-family, anti-feminist, queer-phobic religious leaders and politicians, holds the World Congress of Families, a designated hate group. In 2017, the journalist Claire Provost attended the summit in Bucharest, Hungary, undercover. She wrote of the event, "The conference program described its goal as to unite and equip leaders to promote the natural family. Speakers were explicit. This means a married mother and father and their children. They name-checked diverse fights against comprehensive sexuality education, abortion, same-sex marriage, gender ideology, surrogacy, and euthanasia. But they called for positive, winning messages, alliances, and strategies that go after hearts and minds, recalling the shorthand used repeatedly by the US for winning over supporters and public opinion in the context of wars. Several speakers talked specifically about appropriating the language of human rights to bolster conservative campaigns. The theme of the summit? Building family-friendly nations, making families great again. But whilst it is growing in new ways, the pro-nuclear family agenda has long been sturdy on our shores. In 1987, Margaret Thatcher told Woman's Own magazine that people had grown too dependent on the government for support. She said that people were casting their problems on society, but that there is no such thing. Rather, she insisted, there are individual men and women and there are families. During his leadership, David Cameron became very concerned with broken Britain, blaming troubled families and the slow-motion moral collapse of the country. To whip families into shape, he announced a social and security fight back, which included riot training for thousands more police officers. This ideology of the broken family breaking Britain was reinforced in popular culture. For example, when Anne Robinson, the presenter of the game show The Weakest Link, bullied a single mother of three children for receiving state benefits. She also asked her what happened to the husband if she had gone gay and whether her children had tags on their ankles. Cultural discourse and government policy pursue the model of two parents bringing up children in a private household, requiring as little as possible from their community and the state. The nuclear family is upheld by the state, which, as the sociologist Melinda Cooper writes in Family Values Between Neoliberalism and the New Social Conservatism, is willing to enforce, indeed create, legal relationships of family obligation and dependence where none have been established by mutual consent. In the United States, she points out, this meant welfare was restructured during the New Deal specifically to subsidize white, normative lifestyles. Black, single or unmarried mothers could not claim benefits. Today, it would be a mistake, argues Cooper, to think that neoliberalism is any less invested in the value of the family than our social conservatives. Via multifarious policy measures, governments incentivize the traditional nuclear family, contributing to the pre-constitution of desire. Former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who has been divorced twice and has conceived seven children with three mothers, including one during an extramarital relationship, reigned over policy that promotes a traditional family setup. As neoliberal economic policy divests from healthcare, education, and benefits, the nuclear family is presumed to replace state support. Marriage is incentivized, now too, for people in gay partnerships, and inheritance and next-of-kin legal frameworks make bloodline relationships advantageous in scenarios such as death, rendering non-marital, non-biological bonds largely irrelevant. Marriage certificates and genetic relationships carry weight in immigration and asylum processes. Married straight couples, if they can prove the relationship is not a sham, have a better chance of being granted visas under family reunion, For queer and unmarried partners, being granted residency is much more difficult, often impossible. For all partnerships, consideration for reunion across borders requires certain criteria to be met for the relationships to count as genuine. For instance, Home Office guidance states that couples must have cohabited in a relationship akin to marriage for a minimum of 2 years and intend to live together permanently. Having children together and sharing finances is further evidence of a genuine relationship. Biometric data is collected to confirm people's identities and to determine their real family. In reality, border violence tears families, even real families, apart. Family separation is barbaric. The UK is the only country in the EU that refuses child refugees the right to be reunited with their parents or siblings. In critiques of such border violence, what is rarely acknowledged is the fact that people have other attachments, non-biological and non-legally certified, that matter deeply, perhaps more. In ignoring this fact, we naturalise the moral superiority of normative understandings of family. Keep families together may be an expedient slogan when campaigning for humane immigration laws, but, as Lewis notes, for some people, especially queers, who are much more likely to be fleeing their family of origin and to be yearning for other kinds of kin, the slogan is a literally homicidal notion. Loyalty to the historically recent custom of splitting off into small family units is not the reserve of the right. Recent years have seen the rise of what is sometimes called the trad left. In 2021, Labour leader Keir Starmer rebranded his platform with a socially conservative and boring 12,000-word essay for the Fabian Society, in which he avoided mentioning socialism and advocated for hard-working families. The essay mentions family 21 times and concludes with 10 proposals for a contribution society, the first being, we will always put hard-working families and their priorities first. But, he hastens to add, his are not conservative or backwards ideas. In contrast, his predecessor, Jeremy Corbyn, planned to remove the marriage tax allowance, a financial benefit for those with a legal spouse. As recently as the 1970s, the abolition of the nuclear family was a reasonably common and well-understood demand among revolutionaries. Family abolitionism contends that the institution of the nuclear family is not only an oppressive and often violent kinship ideal, but also a profoundly inadequate one in terms of the connection, love, and care we require and desire to live well in the world. Family abolitionists propose alternative visions for kinship that might better nourish us, communalising the care work that is currently privatised. Having been mostly killed off in the 1980s, when feminism opted for a reformist approach to the family instead, family abolitionism and utopian thought are seeing a revival. This trajectory reflects the growing force of abolitionist politics in general on the left. The 2020 global rising of the Black Lives Matter movement, in response to the murder of George Floyd by a white police officer, ignited and strengthened calls for police abolition. Movements to abolish other oppressive institutions have also gained strength, for example around psychiatry and education. The demand for family abolition is often met with dismay or ridicule. Sometimes this is because people imagine family abolitionists want to bulldozer their family in particular, or to belittle their personal desire for solace within a traditional family unit. These are not the goals of family abolitionism. Family abolition does not want to kill your husband or make you hate your parents. Instead, it asks for the flourishing of all the things that the nuclear family promises but does not deliver. Cradling kinship for everyone, characterised by loving commitment, safety, care, and camaraderie. Looking at the evidence, family abolition is conscious that the family as we know it is failing us, and that we need to create new ways to look after each other, beyond blood. Nevertheless, calling for the upheaval of social mores is always, in the end, going to provoke moral panic in some, especially those whom the current conventions are better serving. In December 2021, there was a normie shitstorm about family abolition on Twitter, with someone asserting that it was an idea pursued by asocial weirdos and very odd people obsessed with mad and bizarre minoritarian rubbish. In fact, the radical critique of the family has a long and rich history attached to black feminism. As the writer and researcher Lola Olufemi tweeted, in response to leftists' reactivity around family abolition, "Read One Black Woman on Kinship, please. You're crying over whether or not Engels said it when it's been focal to black studies and black feminism for decades." Family abolition today is often informed by a 1987 article by literary critic and black feminist scholar Hortense J. Spillers, entitled "Papa's Baby, Mama's Maybe," which argues that the nuclear family is fundamentally shaped by white supremacy and is part of an apparatus of power through which black women in the United States are gendered differently to white women. In her analysis, black families, as with queer and poor families, have not been truly accepted by the dominant culture as families at all. Family, as we practice and understand it in the West, the vertical transfer of a bloodline, of a patronymic, of titles and entitlements, of real estate, and the prerogatives of cold cash, from fathers to sons, and in the supposedly free exchange of affectional ties between a male and a female of his choice, becomes the mythically revered privilege of a free and freed community. However, she writes, African peoples in the historic diaspora had nothing to prove. If the point had been that they were not capable of family, read civilization, since it is stunningly evident that Africans were not only capable of the concept and the practice of family, including slaves, but in modes of elaboration and naming that were at least as complex as those of the nuclear family in the West. Today, the BLM movement has challenged the nuclear family, stating, "We disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure requirement by supporting each other as extended families and villages that collectively care for one another, especially our children, to the degree that mothers, parents, and children are comfortable. We foster a queer-affirming network. When we gather, we do so with the intention of freeing ourselves from the tight grip of heteronormative thinking." The rest of the statement, on a page of the site that has now been removed, clarifies that BLM is committed to family in other senses, in supporting parents and in affirming the global black family. As the writer Jude in London argued in response to the Asocial Weirdos tweet, critiques of the family are not bourgeois or elitist concepts that normies cannot understand. Most working class people understand it perfectly well because, globally, most working class people are already doing it. They are already raising children that aren't theirs with friends, siblings, cousins, partners, neighbours, because it is all they've ever known culturally. Abolish the family is a call to normalise this, not to take your granny away. Indeed, family abolitionist principles aren't nearly as dramatic as some detractors fear. Cuba's new legal definition of the family, for example, is as simple as it is radical: a union of people linked by an affective, psychological, and sentimental bond who commit themselves to sharing life such that they support each other. Now is an apposite moment for the revival of family abolitionism. The pandemic and the ecological crisis it was born from might seem to some like good reasons to drill down into bourgeois, insular family units, to hoard resources and direct survival instincts towards genetic futurity. But, as the pandemic has exposed, the nuclear family is a devastatingly inadequate support group, one that, on its own, will not keep all of us alive. If we rely upon it as our main provision for kinship and care, even more so as we descend into further social catastrophe, marginalised people will continue to face increasing exclusion, neglect, violence, and death. Remaking the world by remaking the family does not mean throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Amidst the violence of the nuclear family, there are ideas and values we might salvage from the wreckage. Presently, the family is experienced as a dependable source of love, care, and safety only by the fortunate few. We must demand this experience for all. A positive supersession of the family, argues O'Brien, means the preservation and emancipation of the genuine love and care proletarian people have found with each other in the midst of hardship. The fun and joy of eroticism, the intimacy of parenting and romance. This love and care, transformed and generalized, is what is to be preserved in the abolition of familial domination. Loosened from the rigid social roles of heteronormative gender and sexual identity, the material constraints of capitalism, and remade in the intensity of revolutionary struggle, the potential of love and care can be finally freed onto the world. The abolition of the family must be the positive creation of a society of generalized human care and queer love. Loyalty and forgiveness are two more family values worth examining as we imagine and create kinship beyond the nuclear and biological. Whilst at one end of the spectrum, families frequently reject queer offspring out of hand, at the other, they purport to be bastions of support through thick and thin. What this often looks like in practice is brushing harm under the carpet. Because family comes first, because we're still family at the end of the day, neglect, abuse, and violence are often permitted within its ambit. The loyalty and forgiveness families sometimes show some members usually looks nothing like transformative justice. Accountability is rare in cultures of domination and silence. Nevertheless, there may be a helpful granule, at least, in the nuclear family's false claim to unshakable devotion, the idea that no one is disposable. In an abolitionist future, a care commune cannot be carceral. It cannot respond to harm with further harm through punishment and ejection. When people hurt each other, as all of us do, we must not turn away, but stand by the person who has been harmed and be led by their needs, while supporting the perpetrator to take responsibility, make efforts to repair, and change their behaviour. The idea is that family is bound by blood, and whilst this principle is responsible for much agony, people who make biological babies often claim that from having progeny there springs hope. Having reproduced, parents recount discovering a new fervour for the future, or being instilled with a greater sense of stewardship over the planet. Could some sense of parental futurity extend outwards, beyond the genetic, to help give birth to a better world? If children are the future, how might making children differently reshape the future? Or, as the activist and scholar Loretta J. Ross asks, how do we get from a conservative definition of mothering as a biological destiny to mothering as a liberating practice that can thwart runaway capitalism? In Revolutionary Mothering, Love on the Front Lines, independent scholar and activist Alexis Pauline Gumbs writes about mothering, especially the mothering of children in oppressed groups, and especially mothering to end war, to end capitalism, to end homophobia, and to end patriarchy, as a queer thing. Mothering might be a way to recreate the self and the world, or as Gumbs puts it, a way of breaking cycles of abuse by deciding what we want to replicate from the past and what we need urgently to transform. Resisting the forces of ecological disaster could indeed be spurred on by wanting a bright future for your child. But caring for the planet need not be, must not be, contingent upon having biological offspring. Many indigenous cultures hold the responsibility of care for all life dear. Ecologies are not simply protected so my kids can enjoy them, but for their own sake, and for the sake of all beings. In this understanding, ecologies are not protected so that extraction can continue for our kin, but because the land, the air, the water, they are our kin. As the author and professor Joseph M. Pierce writes, the practice of land acknowledgements, statements recognizing the stewardship of indigenous peoples over a certain territory, is not enough, because land requires a reciprocal relationship of care, not simply confirmation that it exists. What is crucial, he argues, is territory as kin, building relationships with that land itself, as if it were your kin, because it is. When resisting tar sands pipelines in Minnesota, indigenous water protectors have carried banners saying, "Land defense is a family value." Conception can be reimagined beyond baby-making. Together, we can conceive better futures. As Lewis writes, everywhere about me, I can see beautiful militants hell-bent on regeneration, not self-replication. Recognizing our inextricably surrogated contamination with and by everybody else and everybody else's babies will not so much smash the nuclear family as make it unthinkable. And that's what needs to happen if we are serious about reproductive justice, which is to say, serious about revolution. We know it takes a village. The idea that nurturing children takes more than two parents is not radical. We know it takes a village. Even in the most conventional nuclear families, people call upon extended family for support and appoint godparents. The commonplace inadequacy of childcare support networks, especially for those who cannot afford to pay for backup, has been theorised by Madeline Leigh McKinley and Maria Sitanik as being a cause of postpartum depression. Postpartum depression, they write, describes the social conditions of motherhood under late capitalism, which in turn demands forms of radical kinship already visible in existing frameworks of solidarity and communality. Here, indigenous customs and principles that colonisation attempted to wipe out are instructive. As Talbert argues, perhaps our allegiances and commitments are more strongly conditioned than we realise by a sense of community that exceeds rather than fails to meet the requirements of settler sex and family. The abuse and neglect in so many indigenous families born of colonial kidnapping, incarceration, rape, and killing are all too real. But perhaps our relentless moves to caretake in Tioshpaye more than in normative settler family forms is not simply the best that we can do. Maybe it is the best way to heal. Even the Scottish Government once attempted to formalise a remedy for the nuclear family's scarcity of care by proposing a named person scheme that would have seen every child in the country being appointed a person external to the family to keep a check on their well-being. The named person, usually a teacher or health worker, would look out for the child and perform a kind of checks and balances role for the family. The scheme attracted pushback from the Scottish Conservatives as an intrusion on families, and a legal fight against it was led by the Christian Institute, an evangelical lobbying group. As a result, the scheme was mostly scrapped after the Supreme Court found it to be in breach of the right to privacy and a family life under the European Convention of Human Rights. The legal judgment was celebrated by the Christian Institute, which advocates for conversion therapy for queer and trans people, as a victory for the freedom of families. This freedom of families entails trauma, for, as Paul Jackson writes, when the family is closed to the world, horrible things can happen. What would it mean to have an open relationship family, as he puts it, for queers, trans people and other marginalised groups such as sex workers and rough sleepers? Mutual collective mothering in a broad support network has always been the norm. Amongst these communities, kinship networks are chosen and porous, or, as the writer Armistead Maupin has put it, logical family. While this type of kinship may include communal living, it may also be diffuse between people who share spaces and moments dedicated to care, connection and community. This could take infinite shapes: shared creative pursuits, childcare cooperatives, support groups, sex parties, festivals, co-authoring, political organising. As the comedian and historian Jules Joanne Gleeson argues, for queers, the prospect of putting an end to the domination of private households can come to seem less extreme and more hopeful because it would mean an end to the farce of most queers being raised by heterosexuals. The communist future, she proposes, relies upon the lessons of hustles and community solidarity, as well as the prolonged bouts of joy, rarefied skills, and kinds of support that fellow exiles are uniquely placed to share, being harnessed such that the harm done to us by our families is not only mitigated, but actively overcome. Motherhood, as an exclusionary institution couched in privilege, and mothering, as a practice and an experience, are distinct, argues Adrienne Rich. It follows that anyone can mother, including adults redoing difficult experiences of mothering for each other, and adults caring for children who are not their own. When mothers unlearn domination, as Gums describes, they might also unlearn possession. She quotes a 1979 edition of the lesbian journal Off Our Backs, in which one writer, Doc, shares that one of the stated aims of the Third World Lesbian and Gay Conference was that all Third World lesbians share in the responsibility for the care of nurturing for the children of individual lesbians of colour. In the same journal issue, Mary Pena and Barbara Carey assert that in lesbian families without patriarchal authority, children will not belong to the patriarchy. They will not belong to us either. They will belong only to themselves. Black communities have typically practiced more collectivized approaches to bringing up children, for instance, in traditions of informal adoption. As bell hooks charts, Let's say you didn't have any children and your neighbour had 8 kids. You might negotiate with her to adopt a child, who would then come live with you. But there would never be any kind of formal adoption, yet everybody would recognise her as your play daughter. My community was unusual in that gay black men were also able to informally adopt children. And in this case, there was a kinship structure in the community where people would go home and visit their folks if they wanted to, stay with them or what have you. But they would also be able to stay with the person who was loving and parenting them. Collective child rearing might also entail communalized domesticity in place of the private nuclear household. In the 1970s, members of the revolutionary socialist feminist organization Big Flame in England began having children, and questions of child liberation and the gender division of social reproduction became more pressing within the group. In a 1980 Big Flame discussion bulletin about children and socialism, SC writes about her experience of collective childcare in Leeds. The piece opens, "No section of our society is more under attack in the present crisis than our kids. They are the most vulnerable and powerless of groups, and despite Thatcherism's adulatory attitude to the family, they are being hammered." SC shares how she and her partner decided to live with another couple in order to resist the degree of dependency and possessiveness and insularity that can come with nuclear family living, and to undermine the institution as part of our attempt to undermine the whole system of capitalist and patriarchal oppression. The four adults, along with two others living nearby, had babies around the same time, with a strong conception of doing it together. Between them, they ran a mini creche on a rotor system of 6 adults, and on occasion brought other children into the fold. In this example, collective childcare was part of a wider revolutionary project, which included making political organising accessible for parents and prioritising children's agency. Raising a child confident in the company of those outside their immediate biological family meant that SC sometimes felt she didn't see enough of her child. But, she writes, "it is a liberation for her and for me that she actually demands to spend time away. If she is pissed off with me, she knows she can take her tea to her friends, get support from others, and return when she feels ready." Prioritising freedom and sociality in this way, they believed, supported radical struggle. In the context of their political organising, the meaningful inclusion of children as part of the community, rather than isolating them within the domain of the nuclear family, was also a constant reminder to keep things fun and enjoyable wherever possible. SC concludes, "opening up our relationships with our individual children to others in BF, or Big Flame, can be very difficult, but it can also be extremely rewarding. In my experience, it's the only way to maintain the kind of interest and commitment to the organisation that I want. For our kids, it can provide an invaluable experience of communism, an experience that can begin to encourage in them the seeds of a creative and positive opposition to the system that oppresses us all." Between necessity and desire. Today, leftists are more likely to couch their demands in terms of the tragedy of the nuclear family's demise than to call for its abolition. In his essay, The Road Ahead, Starmer expresses his gratitude that he grew up at a time that made it possible for me to have a family of my own. He laments that young people nowadays are more often unable to earn enough money or have sufficiently secure housing to do the same. This is true. It has become much more difficult to, as Starmer puts it, put down deep roots. But insecurity and inequality of opportunity in society do not come down to the viability of the nuclear family. A better future means loving kinship for the many, not the few. As we build this future, we should keep in mind that doing family differently is not always an active choice people make, but a matter of survival. As O'Brien writes, "new heterogeneous family structures are a symptom of desperation as much as they are of the practice of care. Escaping the familiar harm of the family and seeking alternative kinship may well entail enduring different, significant harms elsewhere." The examples O'Brien gives include a queer youth, freed from a violent relationship with their parents, may be subject to the new risks of street-based sex work. Young mothers, opting not to marry their abusive boyfriends, may find themselves working long hours in retail service and are sexually harassing managers. Life outside the nuclear family under capitalism is no utopia. Indeed, whilst presenting new possibilities for care, it can be difficult or even perilous. As the COVID era has taught us, however, finding new ways to care can feel hopeful. Discovering that we cope better with and find solace and pleasure in more communal approaches could be prefigurative politics. Everywhere, people were reminded of, or perhaps learned for the first time, the beauty of simply knowing their neighbours. In the growth of mutual aid groups, community-led food co-ops, collaborative homeschooling, and even in the proliferation of whole street WhatsApp groups, used to coordinate the delivery of provisions to people isolating, or to ask for and offer other kinds of support, there were glimpses of what it might be like to accept that we need each other, more of us, more. The nuclear family is a scab. A scab in two senses, an injury crusted over by blood and counter-revolutionary. It offers us what Lauren Berlant describes as cruel optimism when something you desire is actually an obstacle to your flourishing. Normative optimism, argues Berlant, is why the exhaustion and corruption of families in the brittle economy produces, nonetheless, a desire in these children for the normal life, the good life, as with Britney Spears. This is a cruel relation because it promises much and may well end up robbing us of the very things we were seeking, like safety, abundant love, and togetherness. In what ways is the nuclear family counter-revolutionary, and how could doing things differently, in turn, support revolutionary struggles? The family is a small unit of people, motivated by genetic loyalty, private property, and inward-looking priorities. Whilst biofamilial solidarity can be a vital and profound experience, it is generally unconducive to building wider-ranging intimacies and comradeship. As Gleason writes, we call for abolishing the family not as a means of disregarding the tireless efforts made by proletarians to preserve the well-being of their relatives, but in awareness that these personal struggles alone will never serve to emancipate us as a class. Effective political action towards a better world requires us to build meaningful constellations of non-biological kinship too. As Silvia Federici has said, the denuclearization of the family is the path to the construction of communities of resistance. Leanne Betisomasake-Simpson explains that the radical, resurgent indigenous struggle against dispossession and settler colonialism and the violence of capitalism, heteropatriarchy, white supremacy, and anti-blackness that maintains them requires family. Not the nuclear family that has been normalised in settler society, but big, beautiful, diverse, extended multiracial families of relatives and friends that care very deeply for each other. Such families demonstrate the symbiotic relationship between intimate life and political action. Indeed, when non-nuclear kinship has been so beleaguered by empire, as independent scholar Carla Bergman and the organiser and writer Nick Montgomery argue, it is not a destination, but a political struggle in and of itself. Creating intergenerational webs of intimacy and support is a radical act in a world that has privatised child-rearing, housing, subsistence and decision-making. Making impossible families possible. Creating and sustaining non-normative families or non-biological kinship groups can be difficult in society as we know it. It could seem impossible. It is made to feel this way, and it will likely remain this way, unless we transform the capitalist society that depends upon the nuclear family to function. This could involve resisting government policies that incentivize and privilege particular modes of living. In The Antisocial Family, Michelle Barrett and Mary McIntosh argue that feminists and socialists, in the interests of greater freedom of choice and the move towards collectivism, must challenge any social policy that strengthens the hegemony of the nuclear family as an institution and makes diverse forms harder. This includes demanding and building a society that does not depend upon the privatised care of the nuclear family, but has the infrastructure to meet everyone's needs for safety and survival without it. As things stand, non-nuclear kinship can feel precarious, since its survival rests upon the conditions of capitalism, which are particularly hostile to it. Normative modes are encouraged not only by the state, but also by our families of origin and the wider culture, probably even by ourselves, our psyches having developed in this context. Although it could really be more supportive, kinship beyond the nuclear family is construed as, and often made, untenable for those with children. Author, performer, healer, and community worker Kai Chong Tom writes of her friends' excitement at having babies. "I used to see my friends' eyes shine that way when we talked about living together, starting a collective, learning how to cultivate food from the land, growing old together, dying together. The problem, as she puts it, is that the revolution never arrived, or at least it hasn't yet. The babies, however, did come for us. These babies," she writes, "seem to be stealing all of my friends, and with them, my hopes for the future. Because, in capitalist society, raising children isn't a communal thing. It is not that she begrudges her friends' decisions. She wants to be a part of their lives. She even dreams of a conventional lifestyle herself. But as a trans woman, the nuclear family structure does not welcome her. Although some might say that growing up means assimilating into heteronormative society, this is not really an option for many queers. It is not an option for me." In making non-nuclear kinship possible, we need to look closely at who has more and less autonomy over their bodies and why. In the case of the women's strike movement, this means refusing unwaged and waged social reproduction and all the work that women do, showing the world that when we stop, the world stops with us. Transforming society so that more kinds of family open up to us could entail many kinds of strike. Reclaiming our bodies in a society that attempts to have power over them, controlling our access to healthcare, including hormones, birth control, and abortion, is part of rejecting the oppressions underlying the institution of the nuclear family. In some cases, a strike could mean refusing to reproduce. Lewis explains that for gestators of oppressed classes, terminating a pregnancy can be a kind of strike, including when contraceptives and safe abortion have been denied or are not readily accessible. She notes that enslaved women, for instance, have used a multitude of tactics to refuse the work of pregnancy and resist participating in the reproduction of slavery. Liberating kinship means seizing the means of reproduction in all manner of ways. Fighting for a broadening of possible alternatives to the nuclear family is also about fighting alongside those who aren't permitted into the ideology in the first place. Because, as Bergman and Montgomery argue, challenging the nuclear family is not about puritanical rejection of anything that resembles it. It is about creating alternatives to its hegemony, to the dismembering of social relations. Increased freedom to build families beyond the nuclear would allow more people to experience enduring group intimacy. It would also allow more people to survive. Not all happy families are alike. Two COVID Christmases in, more people started looking afresh at what family time means. Some lamented being apart from biological family, perhaps coming to appreciate it anew, being in the fortunate position that such time spent mostly lives up to its promised gifts of love and togetherness. Others, especially queers, were relieved at the chance to spend the season with chosen family instead, or alone. For everyone, the pandemic has shown that doing family on autopilot is unsustainable. Despite popular loyalty to the form, it is widely accepted that family fucks us up. Whether through abuse, violence, rejection, neglect, or good old-fashioned emotional unavailability, most of us know that the scars family leaves mark us for life. But, though relationships inevitably involve harm, surely our closest kinship bonds should, by and large, be a source of healing. The latter may be found in transforming existing families or by creating new ones. For some Indigenous populations, Toolbear argues, the reclaiming of expansive visions for kinship, which settlers attempted to crush, is itself a path to healing from colonial violence. Dismantling the hegemony of the nuclear family involves challenging naturalized understandings of social relations. For example, following Meg John Barker and Alex Iantafi's suggestion that we might treat lovers more like friends and friends more like lovers, what if we treated non-biological kin more like biological family and biological family more like non-biological kin? This is a question, not a suggestion. There are many ways in which being like family to each other is terrible, At the same time, what if we extended the commitment, care, and resource sharing that we primarily understand as the domain of family to other kinds of kin, to friends, to lovers, to non-human species, to the land? And what if we brought to our families the same level of communication and boundaries we might try to practice with our friends or lovers? It's the questions that matter. None of this is easy. And yet, as Barrett and McIntosh remind us, if we must avoid the counterproductive stance of self-righteous moralizing, we must also avoid the defeatist stance of colluding with existing family morality on grounds that it is too hard to change or cannot be changed on its own. When faced with self-doubt or those who believe alternative visions are bound to be idealistic, infantile, crypto-reactionary, or insufficiently radical, they suggest we look at the purpose of such criticism. Is it constructive and a valuable part of a political commitment to change, or only a justification for settling down after some youthful experimentation into a conventional family mode? To begin with, we might simply think about, feel into, on our own, with others, maybe even with our families, what it means to nurture in ways that support everybody's flourishing. In holding dear the lives of those who have been most harmed and excluded by the family as we know it, our terrain of struggle should be clear.